Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. Last week, a Senate committee moved bills requiring the governor and Senate legislators to respond to public records requests through Michigan's Freedom of Information Act. Meanwhile, some House Democrats introduced still more transparency bills involving 501c4 or 527 accounts not regulated by Michigan's campaign finance laws. Executive Director Nick Pidgeon of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network and Lisa McGraw, the Public Affairs Manager of the Michigan Press Association, joined the MERS team to discuss the transparency proposals. Also, Stephanie Jones, the founder of the Michigan Fertility Alliance, details why her organization supports legislation authorizing surrogacy contracts in the state. Currently, state statute views surrogate parentage contracts as void and unenforceable. MERS was also joined by Director Julia Dale of Michigan's Unemployment Insurance Agency. She explains how a lack of resources makes it difficult to recover money lost to fraudulent claims made during the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, here's MERS podcast host Samantha Schreiber, MERS editor Kyle Malin, and for the third segment, administrative reporter Andrew Miniger.
Everybody, you heard that correctly. Mark Bayshore, who puts this audio together and who does the final edits on this episode, is back. Thank you so much, Mark, for commencing this episode of the MERS Monday podcast, where we are warming things up with a roundtable discussion that I am titling Our Sunset on Sunshine Transparency Chat. Sunshine Week took place from March 10th through the 16th this year and is ultimately a week dedicated to government transparency and calls for readily accessible public information. Some of the things that happened last week include Michigan Senate Oversight Committee moving legislation last Thursday to the Senate floor, requiring the governor and the lieutenant governor's offices, the House and the Senate, to respond to public records requests authorized under the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, which currently does not apply to the aforementioned groups of elected officials. However, the bills do come with exemptions. For example, for state legislators, communications between a legislator or their office and a constituent who would not be obligated to be a registered lobbyist would be shielded from being disclosed, as well as information related to an unsettled civil action or an internal or legislative investigation. Also, documents affiliated with advice, opinions, or recommendations about public policy or district work for the individual legislative caucuses could not be disclosed. Participating in our Sunset on Sunshine discussion is Executive Director Nick Pidgeon of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, an independent nonprofit corporation focused on promoting transparency in money and politics. Hello, Nick. How are you today?
Good. Glad to be here.
No, thank you so much for joining us. And of course, we are joined with Lisa McGraw, the Public Affairs Manager of the Michigan Press Association. How are you, Lisa?
I'm well, thanks, Samantha.
Now, Lisa, we just talked before hitting record that this is the fifth FOIA extension package that the legislature has worked on, extending it to the governor and legislators, correct?
I think that's correct, yes.
And have you been with the MPA throughout all five iterations?
I have, yes.
Okay, so I think I'll just start with you, Lisa. How are you feeling right now?
Well, I'm feeling optimistic that we're moving in the right direction. This concept, it's a different package this year than it has been the last several sessions, has made it through the House pretty handily all those other times. However, this session, they started it in the Senate because Senator Moss and Senator McBroom have always been leaders on this topic. In the past, Senate leadership, including Senator Meekoff and Senator Shorkey, have not even taken it up. So getting it to the House or the Senate floor, pardon me, is a great step. Obviously, it's not perfect. I like to say it's a good start, and I'm happy to get something passed right now and continue working with the legislature on improving it as we go forward.
Nick, what are some of your initial thoughts of these exemptions?
Well, I know that, you know, they were getting a lot of flack at the beginning. Seems like the exemption was really wide, maybe even covering basically all conversations to any Michigander. And they've had to kind of rein in that scope. You know, I think that they have to, you know, weigh the balances and guess what the challenge is going to be in the courts. And there's, and I think they're still going through that process, you know, and that probably is the biggest hurdle for them finalizing this FOIA extension package.
Lisa, I've been taking a look at this FOIA bill, and we'll start with the governor's office and expanding it to the governor's office. After looking at all of the exemptions, whether it's because of security or you can't disclose work product or whatever, I can't really figure out what is going to be able to be disclosed outside of maybe letters from lobbyists to the governor's office. Can you find something that we would be able to get from the governor's office from this bill?
One of the things I know you'll be able to get, because it was a proposed exemption, not this time around, but in the past, is a copy of her calendar in advance. At one point, there was talk of not releasing it for some number of days after. Myself, people from ACLU and Mackinac Center, including and also MyCog, also kind of protested that and narrowed it down to, well, you have to tell us when you're meeting and with whom you're meeting, but not where, because they were saying it was a safety issue. So we agreed that they didn't have to say exactly where the meeting was, but they need to let us know ahead of time who the governor is meeting with and when.
And would that be in advance, or is that after the fact?
It's in advance now. It was going to be after the fact.
So we could FOIA for the governor's calendar for, let's say, July, and then maybe get it beforehand?
As much of it as is scheduled at this point, yes, you should okay. be able to.
And is there anything preventing the governor from having two separate calendars, a public calendar that she would release and kind of like a private calendar that has her attending a governor's association fundraiser in California?
I don't think there's any language in there that would prevent that. But, you know, that's the case with personal email and email, too. There's only so much we can do, Kyle.
Yeah. So outside of the calendar and then a lobbyist emailing the governor, is there anything else that we could get?
The constituent exemption is pretty wide. I think your reading is accurate.
See, I'm just trying to think out loud. As a reporter, I'm trying to think of, okay, what could I get through this law for the governor's office that would be of value? One of the things that I think is of value is getting where the governor has traveled. And I've long talked about this, but it's in the Constitution. I mean, if it wasn't in the Constitution, I wouldn't be a big stickler about this. But when the governor's out of state, the lieutenant governor is technically in charge. Unless the lieutenant governor is out of state, then it's the secretary of state. But there is no process by which we can ever find out when the governor was ever out of state. We have to go through basically the lieutenant governor's payroll in order to figure this out, and the secretary of state's payroll, which I can tell you is a pain in the rear. But I'm reading through this that they would probably exempt any type of discussion of the governor's travel that has happened as a security issue.
I'm not sure where you're reading that, because as you were speaking, I was thinking old calendar issues you should be able to get. Like if she was in, I want to say Florida just because it's easy. If she was in Florida, you know, next week and you FOIA'd that in May, it seems to me, according to this, you should be able to get that.
But I'm reading in here the security issue, and that has been described to me as reasons why I wasn't able to get it before.
I don't know if the security issue would apply for post.
You wouldn't think so.
Trip, Kyle.
That's but we could take it to court if they deny us anyway, I suppose.
Honestly, I'm so sick of having to take everything and FOIA to court.
I think you raise an interesting point. Is like if it is something that is in the past tense, something that had occurred a month ago, a week ago, I mean, would I dare say several hours ago, is it still a security risk if it's something in the past that doesn't really give you any indication of where a governor is going now, where they currently are or where they're heading to? I think something that as a reporter that I really like to talk about when it comes to this legislation, and I've heard some various concerns about this item, is the FOIA coordinators. And this essentially sets up a system where there is going to be a lot of early first ever discretion scenarios of these brand new FOIA coordinators if the bills are signed into law. And I know there is some hesitancy because on the legislative side, they would be selected by the House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader, fear of them becoming politically exploited bodies. That is a case that I have heard. There is also provisions in this legislation that would require a FOIA coordinator that as they respond to that request, they also have to put forward a reason as to why they are not going to disclose that information, as opposed to just simply rejecting it as another department. You might experience that. Overall, what are kind of, for and Nick, I'm going to bring you into the conversation. What are your thoughts about just the earliness, this state of trial and error, if the bills do get signed into law this year?
Well, you know, I appreciate that change that you just mentioned, that it's, you know, the coordinator it's on the onus of the coordinator to describe, you know, what are the exemptions that we're citing. And still, even if there are exemptions they could cite, you know, they could also choose to still disclose that information. You know, in Michigan, even though we have this exemption for the governor's office, the lieutenant governor's office, it is a pro-disclosure FOIA law. It says that, you know, unless you can cite this exemption, it must be disclosed. You know, I think that it seems like they're taking some time to make sure this passes the legal challenge. You know, we've spoken about how they've had a lot of time to do this, and it seems like these ethics packages and these ethics bills come up at the very last minute, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of backrooms discussion to see what's put forward. But I do appreciate seeing that change that was mentioned.
Lisa and Kyle, I'm going to bring you into the conversation as well with a question. I mean, this is an interesting time for reporters, because normally as a journalist and you cover policy changes, you're viewing that purely objectively. Your job is to report on the change. But for reporters in Michigan right now, there's kind of some personal stake involved. What are your thoughts on right now, some various Capitol reporters, not just Capitol reporters, but anyone covering Michigan politics, you know, really getting personally fired up here? And what are kind of the pros and cons that are affiliated with that type of culture?
Well, I think the pros and the cons are is that you could become an activist. And I think that there is a danger in doing that, because once you become an advocate, then you do lose objectivity. So there is danger in that. But on the other hand, if you don't bring it up, who will? There's always that question too. And you don't really see an interest group outside of the Press Association, which is here, and Nick's group there, but that's campaign finance kind of related. I mean, who brings up the issue of transparency and the issue that, you know, other reporters who are able to cover city hall and county government, they are able to access information through FOIA, but the folks who cover the legislature are not. We are able to access records as it relates to the budget, and we can access payroll information and expenditures. But we can't really go that route with the governor's office. So we deal with it. So we care about it. But you're right. The general public doesn't, you know, whether FOIA expansion gets passed or not, I don't think many people really care. It's just that we care because we are kind of the watchdogs of government. We're just trying to do our job. And if we can't do our job, who else is going to talk about it but us?
If I may, I would say, and I'm not a reporter, I want to clarify that, I'm the public policy person for most of the reporters in the state, the newspaper reporters in the state of Michigan. Part of Sunshine Week as a whole is to try to get out to the public what Kyle was just talking. This is important to you. It's not just a media issue. It is an issue for all citizens of Michigan. FOIA was not written just for journalists. It was written so people could see what those that they elect are doing with their taxpayer dollars. And I would say, from a non-reporter point of view and the person who is the advocate for them, and I'll tell you, Kyle's absolutely right, I can never get them to testify or talk about this stuff for me. But it is, in light of what we've seen in the last couple of years, especially with the legislature and former Speaker Rick Johnson, former Speaker Lee Chatfield, there's just obvious examples of why this is important for us and the public to have access to this information. about what's going on. And I kind of just gave you a segue into the other bills in the House, if you want to use it.
I do want to do that segue, but I do have kind of a question that I am itching to ask real quick before we take the pivot. I mean, and Kyle, you can answer this. Nick, I would love to hear your takes on this. And Lisa, I know that you are essentially an advocate for a bigger group of reporters. But, you know, as professionals who depend on records requests and data availability to do your jobs, I mean, what was a time when you felt most constrained by Michigan's government transparency statutes?
Well, I had mentioned trying to find out when the governor was out of state. I mean, I just think that's the most blatant example of ridiculousness. I mean, it is in the Constitution that when the governor is out of state, that the lieutenant governor take charge. And yet, while I was able to get this information quite easily from prior administrations, for Governor Whitmer's team, it was a field not to be crossed. It was extremely difficult. All of a sudden, nobody had any documentation of any sort that they could give me as to when the governor was out of state and when the lieutenant governor was taking over and when the lieutenant governor wasn't around and when Secretary Benson was taking over. You know, I'm not saying that it's a great part of the Constitution. It's probably outdated and probably doesn't need to be there. But the fact is that it's there. But to get that information, as simple as it might be, turns into a Sherlock Holmes mystery, and several FOIAs. I think I ended up having to do 5 FOIAs before I was able to get payroll information on Lieutenant Governor Gilchrist, and then figure out how many times they get his salary boosted, and you know how much, you know how many hours. I mean, it's just a pain in the neck, and it doesn't have to be that way. It just doesn't have to be. And that's just one example. You asked for one, that's the one that I'll give you. But you could do the same runaround with the legislature and internal investigations. You know, you can FOIA internal investigations and how things go and anywhere else in state government. But under these bills, that's all of a sudden exempted from the legislature and the governor's office. So they can do internal investigations and you'd never know anything about it. But I can FOIA for the internal investigation of the state police, for example. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, no, and to piggyback off of that, it's helpful to the network for us to be able to get a record of these travels. As we all know, we still do not know when a 501c4 or another nonprofit organization is paying for travel or tickets, you know, for any state official, and that still hasn't changed after Prop 1 was implemented. So the only way we can really learn if this is happening is being able to see these travel records, and of course we are unable to do that with the current exemption in the FOIA law.
If I can tag on to that real quick, Samantha, Nick makes an incredibly valid point here that while these two things that came up last week are separate, they're very much tied together. When we want to see who a legislator is meeting with, for example, and maybe tie it together with who's giving money to that legislator, and what the resultant work product might be later down the road that benefits said person. Those sorts of things. It's not one or the other in this situation. It's a combination of these things being put together. And yes, Kyle, we do need to fine tune 669 and 670 or work on them going forward, even if they do pass, because they are, as I've said in committee several times, not perfect, but a start.
You know, and I'm glad that you mentioned, Lisa, the bills that were also introduced for the first time were all travel for legislators and the governor would have to be released, not just that paid for the lobbyists, because they have gotten around that many times, whether it's that trip to Israel or when somebody else takes them, like the National Popular Vote folks took them to, you know, wherever. I mean, those kind of things should be disclosed. I mean, if you're going on a trip that is not paid for by you, it's paid for by somebody else, that is a level of influence. And if you're getting that trip, it would seem like that would be available somewhere. And so the House bill that does allow that at least gives us an idea of who has 501c4s and 527s, I think that's a great idea. Who's buying the tickets? I mean, those bills are bills that, if adopted, would be helpful tools for reporters. I can see getting value out of those bills. Whereas the 669 and 670, I look at it, I'm trying to figure out, okay, what stories am I getting out of these bills? And I'm kind of struggling. But, you know, obviously, like you said, Lisa, we'll see what we can get out of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I also have a question about, you know, if these FOIA expansion bills were to get signed into law, but not the other package of bills from the House. And that includes, you know, under this package, legislators and other state officials would need to disclose if they are connected to a 501c4 or a 527 account under the bills. Also requires state officials to disclose when they go on trips or receive tickets to events that are paid for by someone else. I think an interesting component I see when I just look into the legislative governor's office FOIA bills, I have this question. Are members of the general public, are they going to try filing FOIA requests for something that is a campaign finance 501c4 issue that these bills wouldn't even apply to?
Yeah, no, it's a potential. And, I, you know, in reading what they propose here in the BRITE Act, the 00454 and the 00458, it says that, you know, if a 527 or a 501c4 group has a member who's a state official or a candidate who's on the board of directors or a family member or a staffer is connected or on the board, they would have to file with the Secretary of State. You know, I'm still looking into this, see, okay, does this mean a regular filing of campaign finance reports? You know, I'm not so sure what we're seeing here. You know, I don't know how much the public will, you know, uptake filing their own FOIA requests. But what I know is important is that, you know, for these personal financial disclosures and some other things, it's incumbent on the public to make the complaints. The Secretary of State can only start an investigation into personal finances of our state officials due to proposal two from a complaint from the public. So they need to be very involved in trying to get this information so that they can make those complaints so that we could find any incidents of someone misfiling a report. You know, I think all these transparency pieces are interrelated and connected and separate at the same time.
I want to point out too that we need to all remember, including our friends in the legislature, that the citizens of this state spoke 2 years ago, quite overwhelmingly, that they want transparency from their legislature and their governor. And I think that should be kept in mind as we go forward, especially as the legislators go forward, that this is what their constituents want, whether they use it or not. Obviously, there's some awareness out there that it's something that needs to happen.
If I could jump in really quick, I mean, it, you know, and to piggyback off that, yeah, it's great, you know, that we've seen this BRITE Act, but to bring up proposal two, how that was handled was very unfortunate, right? They knew about it since November of 2022, and it was the last thing taken up in the 23 legislative session, way past my bedtime at 2:30 in the morning, gaveled down every single amendment. There was no discussion besides some comments right before taking the vote. And there were many people in the media, and I testified to the Senate Oversight Committee about this issue with travel payments and gifts. And, you know, we saw no discussion of this, and this was passed in the middle of the night. So, you know, people spoke, and it's very important to them. And, you know, I think that this BRITE Act is part of, you know, our legislators trying to remedy and do what's right, you know, after that fiasco of Proposal 1.
Speaking of that fiasco, I mean, I think that's why that there is a lot of hesitation here with these FOIA bills, that we might see a repeat, that with all the other things that probably need to be done with FOIA as far as folks' inconsistencies in adhering to the law as it is right now, the legislature has been stuck on this treadmill for the last 5 years where it keeps talking about doing the same thing over and over and over again. And we don't see anything. And then maybe at the end of this session, let's just say, for example, maybe they would pass something that would be purported as an expansion of FOIA, but it really doesn't give us any documents we can't already get. And then they'll declare mission accomplished. And then, oh, by the way, it doesn't take effect until January 1, 2027. You know, I'm just concerned, and maybe I'm just being jaded because I've seen this happen the last several sessions where nothing's happened, but there just doesn't seem to be a real genuine discussion on what some of the problems with FOIA happens to be as far as some agencies going certain way with it, taking an exorbitant amount of time, saying we'll get to it when we get to it, other agencies charging thousands and thousands of dollars. And oh, by the way, if you don't like it, you can take it to court. And then other people taking the redaction situation going way out of control and redacting entire documents. you know, there are so many things that we should be talking about with FOIA, and for the legislature to continue just making it about themselves year after year after year is not really helping anybody.
My goal is to, as Kyle says, I've watched this come and go how many times now, want to see something get done that we can continue to work on. As far as the other FOIA stuff, Kyle, we are working on that in the background, on the delays, on the redaction issue, on the costs, all those sorts of things. We have worked with Mackinac Center and come up with some ideas to try to fix some of that. But you have a very valid point in that this one always seems to be the one on the front burner.
And I appreciate that, Lisa. I know you, that you do great work over there, and I know that you've heard these concerns and you're trying, but it does seem like the legislature has a very tunnel vision. They can only handle, seem one thing on their plate at a time. So
I'm not going to argue with you on that.
We are near the end of today's conversation, but what would you all, what else are you all thinking in terms of what needs to be added to the transparency pie, as I would call it? I mean, what else are kind of your thoughts now as we walk away from another sunshine week in the state of Michigan?
We'll go first. I've said this over and over, and Kyle's probably heard me say it before, and the words came up earlier. It would be my ultimate goal for people who are elected in this state and paid by taxpayer dollars to realize that FOIA is indeed an essential service. It is not a burden. It is something that helps keep our democracy strong. And if we could get elected officials from top to bottom to realize that, the inner workings of our government would be much smoother and more transparent.
Certainly. No, I agree. And what I think is really important, of course, as the guy from the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, is this disclosing dark money affiliations and, you know, having 527s and 501c4s have to file with the Secretary of State. You know, that's a part of it right now, but there's really a lot of questions as what this is going to look like and what they have to file. I actually testified to the House Ethics and Oversight Committee last Wednesday for Sunshine Week, just spelling out all the different vehicles for fundraising and a specific example of how a 501c4 can anonymize donors to different independent expenditure groups. And I think that the public cannot get a clear picture of who is funding the majority of the spending in elections if we can't find out who is spending behind these 501c4 organizations, because they only have to file a Form 990. And they don't have to disclose their donors. So I think that's a really interesting part of this Bright package. I think that there are a lot of people concerned about independent expenditures and dark money in Michigan's elections. So I want to see what this looks like, you know, as this bill materializes.
I would only say that the FOIA bills and open meetings, they came about after Watergate. And ever since then, the government has found ways to get around complying. And the legislature has not been, in turn, responsive to making sure everyone is playing by the same rules, because they are most definitely not. And so instead of just giving the folks who are bringing this up, which are the reporters, a pat on the head and saying, we got you and whatever, at some point, we got to see something. It's been 40 years and we haven't seen anything. You know, the expansion of FOIA to legislature and the governor aside, you know, we're getting less and less and less from FOIAs, and it's costing more and more, and it's taking longer and longer and longer. It should not take 6 months, shouldn't take a year, 2 years to get a FOIA. It's absurd. And yet, you know, we're going to just keep going round and round on whether we're going to get a legislator's calendar or not. I just think the priorities are misplaced. And at some point, there's got to be some action, because I think the reporters will just continue to get jaded by this.
Now, everybody, that is Nick Pigeon, the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, as well as Lisa McGraw, the public affairs manager of the Michigan Press Association. Thank you all so much for taking the time to participate in the Sunset on Sunshine Roundtable.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
When When it comes to efforts in the country to becoming pregnant and delivering a child through various fertility procedures, between 1999 and 2013, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, reported that throughout the United States in that time frame, 2%, or 30,927, of all assisted reproductive technology cycles featured a gestational carrier, or in other words, a surrogate who carries and delivers a child without having a genetic link to them. The number of these surrogates in the U.S. has grown from 727 in 1999 to 3,432 in 2013. And between those dates, 18,400 infants have been born. Although a national presence of these surrogates has increased, Michigan follows a 1988 state statute deeming state surrogacy contracts as void and unenforceable as contrary to public policy in the state, and knowingly entering into a surrogate parentage contract for the purpose of receiving compensation in the state can result in a one-year $10,000 misdemeanor. But right now in the state Senate, there is a package of reforming bills being led by State Representative Samantha Steklov, a Farmington Hills Democrat, authorizing the official creation and recognition of surrogacy contracts, with those involving compensation to be included in Michigan. These reports bring us to our second segment of the MERS Monday podcast today, where we are joined by grassroots proponent of this legislation at hand, Stephanie Jones, whose journey consists of going from an engineer within Michigan's automotive industry, as well as a private investment company leader, to becoming the founder of the Michigan Fertility Alliance. Hello, Stephanie. How are you?
I'm doing great. Great this morning. Thanks for having me, Samantha.
Well, just to kick off our conversation, let's start from the very beginning here. How did you first become familiar with the state Surrogate Parenting Act of 1988?
It was from a hospital bed in a, you know, in an ICU. I was recovering from a very traumatic near-death pregnancy complication while trying to conceive our second child. And, you know, I won't go into all the details, but what I experienced was a very rare type of ectopic pregnancy, not a tubal ectopic, but it's called a corneal ectopic, and caused me to, you know, be left fighting for my life. And at that point, the doctor that saved my life, who, you know, I credit so much to, she really was fighting for me. She also told me at that point, you know, you're going to need to look into surrogacy if you want to have any more children, because you're going to be unable to carry a pregnancy. So interestingly, you know, the type of infertility I have, which is technically secondary infertility, it's not primary infertility because I had my son naturally. It is not included in the one in six statistics of people who suffer from infertility, which is a really, you know, an interesting topic we can definitely chat about as well.
Were you someone, have you personally utilized a surrogate? Have you looked into it? How did you get into establishing this organization that you lead?
Yeah, and kind of to, you know, take from what I was, the question before, I was in the hospital recovery bed, told that, you know, surrogacy is really is going to be your only option to have a child using your egg, your husband's sperm. And I started doing some basic research thinking, okay, well, I know I have a friend, you know, I'd heard of someone else that had had a child via surrogacy. They had had cancer and so on and so forth and survived and couldn't carry a child anymore. And I thought, okay, I'll just start researching. They did not live in Michigan. And that's when I, through some basic Google searching, was gobsmacked to realize that Michigan has a pretty much a ban on surrogacy in our state. You will hear things like non-compensated surrogacy is legal. Technically, the word shouldn't be legal. It is tolerated. There is no legal framework that actually protects it or governs it. So that's the point that I heard, you know, I learned about that. So, you know, this is a great point. The 1988 law makes this assumption that all families who suffer from infertility or are unable to carry a pregnancy have an all access pass to a woman who can in our state. That's how the law is written. So we did not fall into that category. After searching and trying to find anyone who would be willing to carry for us, it wasn't an option. We had went through three different failed, what would they call matches here in the state for a woman who was willing to so generously carry for us. They failed screening, which I imagine we'll probably get into the rigors of screening for a gestational carrier. And we had no other option. So we went out of state and we worked with a carrier out of state, working through, you know, the various resources available to families in the surrogacy space. So, and we had our daughter in May of 2020.
What state did you go to, if you don't mind me asking?
We went to Kentucky. So in Kentucky, where we were able to have a legally recognized contract, we were able to compensate a carrier, which is obviously such an important aspect of this legislation. And we were able to receive a pre-birth order. So the state of Kentucky recognized us, myself and my husband, as our daughter's parents prior to her birth. So we had this very crucial document when we went to the hospital in the midst of the pandemic, think where we were as a country in May of 2020, to have our daughter and be able to make all medical decisions about her care and be, you know, viewed as just that, her parents. We were also at that, because we had that pre-birth order and because our names were going to be going on the birth certificate, we were also able to add her to our insurance.
So did your surrogate, did she carry the pregnancy while in Kentucky or did she come to Michigan? Did you spend time in Kentucky?
Oh yeah, we spent time in Kentucky. You know, we were there for her 20-week scan and all the important milestones. You know, we met her obviously prior to extensively, her and her family. And no, our carrier never, because of Michigan law, our carrier never traveled to Michigan. It was actually written into her contract to, she was unable to travel to Michigan for her safety as well. And that was because of our surrogacy ban here in Michigan. It was a wonderful experience. She was obvious, she was a gestational carrier for a reason, right? She had two completely uneventful, healthy pregnancies. She was a very healthy woman. She was able to pass the very rigorous screening to be a gestational carrier. She's a professional, you know, has a degree and has a professional career in accounting. And, you know, but more so, and most importantly, she wanted to help another family who couldn't carry a pregnancy. I mean, that was really what drove her to do something so selfless, right? The selflessness. And it, sometimes I lack words to articulate how these carriers and what they're doing is a superpower. It is such an amazing gift.
Because currently in Michigan, surrogacy contracts are barred, those involving compensation. Is there exploitation occurring between prospective parents and surrogates in the state right now? Because I think you described it to me before we started recording as kind of this underground surrogacy arena here in the state.
Well, you know, one thing that you said, and I want to clarify, is all contracts are unenforceable. It doesn't matter if there is a compensation component or not. So that's important to understand. So even in non-compensated arrangements, which some people use the term altruistic, that is not a term that we agree with at the Michigan Fertility Alliance and kind of across the industry, because all surrogacy, no matter if it is compensated or not, is altruistic, meaning it is done out of the goodness of these carriers' hearts. They want to help a family. The compensation wouldn't negate that. It wouldn't say that that's not the case. So do I think there's exploitation? No. And why do I think there's not exploitation? I'm talking, I guess, let's define the term exploitation. When we think exploitation and we think to the extreme version that people may think of, because we have so many legal safeguards, obviously, in our just human rights standards that would prohibit someone from being in that situation. However, I do think the 1988 law unintentionally exploits the kindness of these carriers by providing them no legal protection whatsoever through the entire gestational carrier process, and also views them as the parents, the carrier and the carrier's spouse. That is a huge risk that people, I don't know if you have to kind of, you have to sit with it and really think about that. They are viewed as the parents. So if something catastrophic were to happen to the intended parents through the gestational carrier journey here in Michigan, how do they take on that responsibility when they're trying to do something out of the goodness of their heart and provide, be able to provide the family building experience for someone who can't? So it's a mixed bag. You know, the nice thing about the Michigan Family Protection Act is, regardless of what I just said, it creates a legal framework that clearly defines all of these layers of protections for the gestational carrier. So nothing, there's no potential exploitation. And also it follows a human rights framework, which is backed by many, many, you know, endorsing organizations that endorse exactly what this framework is, you know, the age requirement, the separate legal counsel, medical evaluation, mental health evaluation, the option for compensation, which is, that's a huge piece, right? If that is, it removes the potential for exploitation. And also, you know, which is so important, it allows the gestational carrier to make all decisions about their body and the pregnancy. So a lot of agency built into that. Now, hypothetically, without this type of legislation, in Michigan, you know, being the only state that has a criminal ban, and there are 47 other states that legally protect surrogacy, in a hypothetical sense, something like that potentially could happen in Michigan without this legislation. So there's reality, there's, you know, kind of the hypothetical situation, and then there's what this legislation does.
Yeah, I had heard this example of health insurance. Ooh, whose health insurance will the child be under? And who would be responsible for essentially being the person who covers that child's health care after they are born?
Right. And as I mentioned, you know, with our journey with our daughter, we were able to add her to our insurance, and our insurance recognized us. You know, there are certain criteria you must meet to add someone to your, as a dependent, to your insurance. So we were able to meet that. But then you go to people in Michigan, and typically these children aren't on anyone's insurance, and Medicaid is picking up the bill, because these are what planned for, much loved, wanted children that parents just don't have the legal documentation to add to their insurance. So it also is, and these children are being born consistently in Michigan. A lot of people don't, because they're not in this world, they don't understand how many children are being born via surrogacy in our state. And this is happening, right? I mean, you've heard cases where twins were born and in a NICU for weeks, you know, Medicaid picked up that bill, so on and so forth. It's very concerning, and it's very antiquated.
I mean, a question I have, can you tell me a little bit about who are the surrogates that you meet? I know that you want to talk a little bit about the surrogate screening process. Can you just kind of let our listeners know, who are these people?
Yeah, they are heroes, right? They're the bravest people that I know. And they go through such a rigorous screening process. It is really very challenging to be even approved to be a gestational carrier. You know, there are the rigors. You have to be 21 or older. You have to have already had a previous pregnancy that had no complications. You know, a lot of times you cannot be in any type of financial support. You have to be of perfect weight. You have to be of perfect age. You have to pass a medical screening. You have to have all your medical records reviewed. You have to open them up to every single medical record, including your pregnancy records. You have to pass a mental health screening. Your spouse has to pass a mental health screening. And also you have to, obviously you're agreeing to this process, right? This is before even anything happens. You're agreeing to all of that. You can't be taking certain medications that many people take regularly. There's so many things they say, you know, and this statistic is hard to fact check, but it definitely is out there because 2-5%. So very cool. Few people.
So what are some of the things that would get flagged on a surrogacy screening that would make someone ineligible? You know, what are some of the most common things you've heard of?
One of the most common things would be a pregnancy complication from a previous delivery. So in the fertility clinic, doctors and our, you know, they find something that to you might not seem like a red flag, but to them, right? They want to create the best possible outcome for the situation. Also would be BMI. That's a huge one. I mean, they have a very strict guideline for BMI. It really goes on for, and BMI, you know, body mass index, which everybody can have their own opinions about it, but it does give a standard in the industry about, because you're going to gain weight, obviously, as most women do when they're pregnant. There are mental health evaluations. That doesn't seem to be an issue, because most of the time, by the time someone is selected to be a gestational carrier, they're doing it for a lot of reasons, but that definitely is there as a safeguard. Medications that people are taking that they don't realize wouldn't be allowed to be taken through a pregnancy, and they choose to continue that medication versus go off it while being a surrogate. You know, there are so many things, but most of the time it is the medical screening that flag, and most carriers cannot make it through the medical screening. And it is for this high blood pressure. I mean, high blood pressure is predetermined for something like preeclampsia, so on and so forth. It is as I said, we went through three in-state women that you would see and think these are healthy women with children that could not pass medical screening. And when we went out of state, we had a fourth person who could not pass medical screening. We are one family, right? I want to put it out there just so that hopefully people understand.
Could it be being a smoker, being a vapor? Could that make you ineligible?
Well, I mean, that's just, yeah, obviously that would be a screening aspect that would probably pre-screen someone and make it so they weren't able to be a gestational carrier. It wouldn't even get them probably to the medical screening. They wouldn't pass pre-screening. And that would be obviously more so because they could be very willing to quit or take a hiatus from the smoking or the vaping. However, medical professionals know that addiction and draw is very strong. So they wouldn't want to put obviously a child at risk at that point.
You know, some of the opposition of this legislation and some of the critics of these bills really point to how the package would eliminate the pre-existing statute that makes it a $50,000 five-year felony for individuals who enter surrogacy contracts with someone with a disability, an intellectual disability, and minors. I think my question for you would be, why is it important to just eliminate the old statute altogether, as opposed to maybe coming to an agreement where you keep some of those $50,000 five-year felonies, just to give individuals the peace of mind?
You know, that is outdated language. We know this legislation follows best practice framework, which is pulled from the UPA, the Uniform Parentage Act, which is, you know, I would tell people that's model legislation that's crafted by experts and across the country bipartisanly. And what that does is it really doesn't do anything. It doesn't really say anything, to be honest with you. It says basically that penalties are going to be used to protect these individuals, when we know good legislation puts proactive guidelines in place to protect these individuals. And you know, one thing that the opposition never mentions when they bring up their fear-mongering attack on this legislation using the repeal of that is this legislation has multi-layer protection for anyone entering a gestational surrogacy contract, such as a minimum age requirement. It's in black and white in the legislation that states they must be 21. The black and white language that says they must pass a medical evaluation by a licensed doctor states that they must pass a mental health evaluation by a licensed mental health professional. They must, they have to have legal independent counsel from a licensed Michigan lawyer. So right there, I've just given you, you know, four indications of layers of protection. And also, you know, one thing that they're also forgetting is that this legislation does not exist in a vacuum. We already have well-tested laws in our books that protect vulnerable individuals with felonies, right? So this is not something that is on an island and doesn't exist without the other framework in our statutes. So that was kind of important. And most importantly, you know, language such as that, and this is a very strong feeling I have, it perpetuates this idea that somehow in surrogacy, it's bad actors, right, behaving badly. And that's not the case whatsoever. I mean, we don't hear of people being taken advantage of or in, you know, people with disabilities or minors in surrogacy, right, in the U.S. And that's because we are in the U.S. We have a strong human rights framework. And we have extreme legal guidelines that protect this. Now, in Michigan, where we have nothing, you know, that potentially could happen. And it's really, really concerning. And then actually, you know, Senator Irwin brought up a great point in hearing, and I do want to drive this home. That statute that they're speaking to also states mental illness. So someone with mental illness, when we use just as a whole, as a society, very broad terms towards something as nuanced as mental illness, right? We end up in a bad place of generalizing the term. So does that mean someone with a bout of depression in college is unable to be a gestational carrier? And then not only the person who goes into the contract is facing that penalty, they themselves are facing that penalty. It's just really poorly written language, very outdated, doesn't follow best practices. It needs to go away and obviously needs to be replaced by what we are doing here that is very protective and very proactive.
Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to join us on the MERS Monday podcast. Everybody, that is Stephanie Jones, the co-founder of the Michigan Fertility Alliance. Thank you for being on the MERS Monday.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
our final segment of the MERS Monday podcast is Director Julia Dale of the Unemployment Insurance Agency, or the UIA, in Michigan. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the UIA in the state went from a four-week average of 100,000 claims for unemployment benefits made in February 2020 to around 1.1 million in initial claim filings taking place from March 15th to April 11th of that year. Director Dale was appointed to her post in the end of September of 2021 and very quickly became responsible for assessing and often attempting to answer to everything unprecedented that happened and everything reportedly wrong that took place during this pandemic timeline. Director Dale, first off, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Now, I feel like with us essentially kind of being in the four-year anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic, I really want to kick off our conversation by asking, what would you say are the biggest vulnerabilities that the pandemic exposed in our unemployment infrastructure that continue to be a remaining burden 4 years later today?
Sure. And I did want to just add one note. I did come into the role in October of 21, at the end of October. And it only matters because we're keeping count of how long I've been in this role. And we're eager to be able to identify when I've been the longest serving director, given the turnover. But, you know, I think there are numerous challenges that were revealed during the pandemic, but those that remain, the two most significant, I would say, are the technical system and our limited human resources. I think much has been said already of the limitations the existing system posed during the pandemic. It was very clear that this decades-old system was not prepared for 2020, 2021 problems. And it posed challenges for both internal users as well as certainly external users. And that's why we're in the midst of replacing it. I think the other greatest challenge, as I mentioned, is our human resources limitation. The UIA has roughly 50% of the full-time employees it had at the beginning of the Schneider administration. And we know that if we want to provide Michigan workers and businesses the level of customer service that they expected during the pandemic, and certainly since then, that we need to think about the ability to bring on more full-time staff. The legislature in the past has limited the number of full-time staff that we can bring on. And over the last 2 years, I've used limited term staff funded by grant dollars from federal grant programs. And we know that eventually those grant monies are going to run dry.
Director Dale, you have an interesting background and a personal experience on the unemployment front growing up. Can you kind of just give our listeners a little bit about your backstory and your experience with public benefits?
Absolutely. I grew up in a small town just south of Lansing area and grew up in an environment that was really challenging, marked by domestic violence, drug and alcohol use. And when I was in high school, my mother was able to work up the resources and the courage to leave our dad. I'm the oldest of two siblings. And for the first 2 months, as a matter of fact, of my high school career, I lived in a hotel in Lansing, and we commuted back and forth from Lansing to where we went to school so that we couldn't be found. My mother had to seek additional work options. At the time when she and my father were married, he had very, I would say, traditional conservative notions about her working outside of the home. And so all of a sudden, she was a single mother with no full-time employment and took on roles like cleaning office buildings and working at our local McDonald's. We received food stamps and unemployment, and it was a very challenging season. When you go from living a fairly comfortable middle-class living to life to having nothing, you know, living in a home that did not have furniture, having to roll pennies or quarters to pay for the things that food stamps won't cover, it makes, there's a certain level of awareness as an adult now, looking back, of the trauma that comes when disaster happens to families. And so I think my experience of living in a very vulnerable situation of having my life changed dramatically by poverty, makes me more empathetic, and it informs the decision making that I approach this role with.
You had that column piece outlining those struggles that you experienced in your family's household in the Detroit Free Press. It was a opinion article published on February 22nd of this year titled "How Surviving on Food Stamps Helped Me Lead Michigan's Unemployment System." What did you want the message to be sent to those readers? What was the end goal of putting that column out?
The intention behind the piece was to shed light on the essential role that government and other social programs play in helping families that are on the brink of disaster. I knew firsthand that government plays a very necessary and important role in serving the most vulnerable in our communities. As you mentioned, the work is very personal to me. And I also think it's important to personalize the experience. You know, one reader had shared in response to my essay that we often don't look like what we've been through. And I'm sure for many people, I didn't look like the face of poverty, of food stamps, you know, of someone who saw strangers appear in their driveway with a box of Christmas presents. And I think it's important to highlight the shame that families experiencing hardship experience and to remove that shame. And I think by sharing my personal story and experience with poverty, there's an opportunity to challenge certain assumptions that people might have about those that receive benefits.
You know, Director Dale, one of those projects you guys are doing, it involves Deloitte and the technology used for the interface that people use when getting unemployment insurance. Could you update the listeners about that transition, as well as when is it expected to be completed?
Absolutely. That's a really exciting piece of what we're doing. We've talked a lot, Andrew, about transforming and modernizing the UIA. And most people think automatically of IT systems when it comes to modernization. And there are other components as well. The Deloitte system, what Deloitte has branded as UFAX, will replace both the internal and external facing system for customers. And it is an incredible project. It is consuming a lot of our time, but it's an exciting one. We are looking to launch in two releases. The first release will be a release that is geared towards employers and the services we provide employers. And then the second release will be on the benefit side. And that will be complete in 2025. And I think one of the things that is really exciting is that we have seen Deloitte launch systems in other states. And what we've done here in Michigan is sit down and talk with leadership in Colorado and talk with leadership in New Mexico about the experiences or the projects that they, you know, implemented to maybe tweak the system. And we're learning from their experiences. We're capitalizing on the work they have already done. And then we're building upon it and being able to see how it is we can just further improve this system for the Michigan experience.
What would you say is your most bold idea right now when it comes to ways you would want to change Michigan's unemployment infrastructure?
I think, and I'm going to apologize right now if you can hear the dog barking. I tried to lock him away, but so I'm going to apologize.
I am personally very pro dog. Okay. So we have guest stars, a guest cameo in the background to our listeners.
So I think one of the boldest ideas that I have in mind is related to artificial intelligence. I will tell you that in my family, we're early adopters of technology. I think there are so many opportunities before us. And one of the things we're exploring, I would say in the infancy stages right now, how UI might use generative AI for everything from content synthesis and generation to customer engagement. I'm looking at how we can use it to influence coding or software. I really do think that the opportunities are boundless when it comes to artificial intelligence. And I'm excited to see how we can use those insights to enhance the customer service experience, as well as our client outreach.
Director, we got a press release from Senator Jim Brunstad a couple weeks ago. He had noted that there is a business in his district called Unemployment Services, Inc., which he says has processed approximately 45,000 unemployment claims since 2018. And he said of those claims, it found that 47% of those claims were legitimate, meaning that the claimant was laid off or let go at will or the hours were reduced, and that 53% were not. Of those, we had 32% who quit, 8 who were discharged for cause. And he's asked the Auditor General to take a look into this data. Are you aware of this letter, and how would you respond to it if so?
I am aware of this letter. As a matter of fact, the UIA has for the last 2 years, and it, certainly over the last 1 year, engaged directly with the owner of this business. We actually provide her with direct contact to my leadership team and email back and forth regarding her concerns almost on a daily basis. We recognize that there, I can't speak specifically to those statistics to say whether or not those are accurate. What I can tell you is that we have engaged directly with her and with also Senator Runstead's office for the last several months regarding the specific issues. I think there are a couple opportunities there. Certainly, we know that some of the concerns they've raised, we've shared, are due to system limitations that would not make sense for us to invest monies right now to change the old system when we're replacing it with the new system. And we've outlined the many different ways the new system will meet the concerns. The other thing is we know that there are certain opportunities that exist provided by the Department of Labor to make the process for third-party administrators easier to process and respond to claims. And that is something we've also shared with their office, that this opportunity exists if they would like to take advantage of it. And so I think at this point, a call for an audit would probably be premature, and we have shared with Senator Runstead's office in great detail some of the actions that we've taken in response to the concerns they have.
And what have been some of those actions when a claim has been flagged as not actually having been eligible to receive benefits?
I think there is some challenge to the analysis of each claim and maybe the reflection of those numbers and the accuracy. But certainly where there is opportunity, if there has been an error on our part with a staff member who's evaluated claim, then we reach out to that staff member, we offer retraining, we go back through and we correct those. I'm not sure that that's been the case in every circumstance. Again, what we have found in some instances is there's some challenges when it comes to how the opportunities that exist for that particular administrator to engage with our system or with the DOL system. And so we continue to work case by case through every question that they raise to us, recognizing that at sometimes we might disagree on the circumstances.
Director Dale, your predecessor had a large problem with fraud. And I'm wondering, with what we're talking about now, as well as what you had said during some of your statements about fraud, what it is that is being done to kind of crack down on not just the ineligible claimants, but fraud in general?
We are doing so many things, and I'm glad you asked, because it's something that I'm very proud of the work that we're engaged in. First of all, I referenced earlier the challenges we have to our human resources. One of the things that we are able to do through an integrity grant from the DOL is bring on nearly, I'm thinking we're about 70 limited term staff to assist in our fraud and investigations unit, recognizing that in order to work through the large number of fraud claims that came during the pandemic, we needed additional resources. And so one, we brought on about 70 staff, and they have been here and will be able to be here at this point with the grant monies, it looks like through the end of this year, the end of 24. We continue to work with local and federal law enforcement agencies, and our work, and these numbers are up since those that we released in December, has resulted in 162 people charged, 91 convicted, and 71 sentenced. We've also recovered more than $90 million and have had restitution in the amount of $26.8 million ordered. And so when there is this, I think, unfortunate sense. And so we need to do, we do what we can to communicate over and over again that we are out there pursuing bad actors. Those numbers continue to grow when we look at the recovery and the restitution ordered. We like to work with our local and federal law enforcement to share the press releases about the charges that we have seen come through or the convictions and sentencing. And so in addition, though, in order to continue to focus and drill down on those efforts, we also developed a new legal and compliance bureau. And those, you know, that leadership team there is continuing to work with the AG's office to develop stronger memorandums of understanding that highlight our obligations. We're continuing to offer training for staff in our investigations team to ensure that they are writing reports that are going to be successful when we look at prosecution efforts, and to continue to help us build efficiency into that investigation process.
I have two questions. And the first one is, you dropped some numbers. Is that directly related to the reportedly $8.5 billion that was lost to fraudulent payments during the COVID-19 timeline?
Yes, it is. And there, and I wish I, you know, in greater detail, I could break down that $90 million and where it's attributable to, but I can at least split the $90 million recovered and that's been ordered restitution from the courts. And that's that $26.8 million.
There's so much money, though. I mean, obviously, following the pandemic, the UIA became under scrutiny for making an estimated $3.9 billion in overpayments on top of that $8.5 billion reportedly lost to fraudulent payments. How much of that money do you think we would realistically be able to recover? How much?
That's a good question. And I don't think that there's a way for me to put a number on that. What I can tell you is that states like ourselves are working with the feds. And one of the challenges they have, as well as resources, we know that we see a certain threshold identified for, you know, it's the amount that is taken by a bad actor for it to be financially feasible for the, you know, worth the, I think, the investment of time and effort. So if there's a threshold amount, then we know that we've got to focus on those higher dollar value targets that we can pursue. We see the same thing, you know, in other states where they're questioning how much of this can we pursue and how do we get the support to pursue these bad actors? And it really does come down to resources.
How many vacancies would you say that there are right now in the UIA in Michigan?
Very few. I am very passionate about making sure that my staff has the resources they need. I think of the FTEs that we have allotted, there's maybe only three that are not accounted for. We do recognize that we have a rolling turnover and the UIA shares human resources with LEO as a whole. And so we are very grateful for the way they prioritize filling our vacancies, but there is some recognition that there will always be a catch up with turnover on staff, but we are aggressively filling every position we can. And I am making sure that we take advantage of every FTE that we have available to us.
I do just have one more question about the Senator Runstead press release. If you don't mind me poking that just one more time. When you think about it, when an employer raises a concern about how someone receiving unemployment benefits had actually quit their job, they were discharged for a cause, things that would make them ineligible for benefits, do you think that the UIA has the appropriate amount of resources to further investigate that flag?
So I think that's a great question. And I would go back to stating that we would certainly welcome additional resources at any time. I don't think there's, in fact, the one state agency out there that wouldn't raise their hand and say, we need more full-time employees. But we also recognize that not only do we need the authorization, we also need the funding to go along with that. And so I think that with the resources we have, I will say in Senator Runstead's case, I can tell you that we are specifically looking at every claim that has been raised by that administrator to make sure that we are addressing and following up on those.
And if I could, then those numbers that were supplied here in this letter from the Unemployment Services, Inc., mm-hmm. Have you been able to verify that? Are these numbers accurate that 53% of the claims that went out the door shouldn't have been awarded?
I can follow back up with you on that, Kyle. I do believe there's some discrepancy with those numbers. And I've been in contact with Senator Runstead's office regarding that release.
And I know that this went back to 2018, and so that there was a rough period there. How much in the recent times, let's say since you took over, do you believe are claims that were not properly granted? Do you have any numbers on that?
Not available right now, but I can check with our team. I'm sure we do.
So, Director Dale, there, given that there's also an appeal, anybody who's denied ever been on unemployment can attest that most employers are the ones who don't want to pay it. So they do flat out deny it to begin with. And under appeals, how many of these would you say would be reversed on appeal?
I don't know that I could give you an exact percentage, but I do know in this instance, there is also a timeliness when it comes to the appeal process. And I think that can also be a challenge for both employers and workers to manage. But that is something that I can follow back up on for you.
Do you have any additional comments or final messages you would like the world to know?
I think there's a couple things I would just draw is that the UIA has engaged in, you know, there's a several projects we've engaged in from the claimant roadmap to the Employer Help Center, our Community Connect program. And I think that's a great opportunity to highlight the commitment we have to transforming the organization. In the Community Connect program, we recognize that while many places were closing offices, it was important not only to have our offices still open, but to go out into communities across the state of Michigan. We know that barriers faced by people in, you know, the Upper Peninsula are different than barriers that are faced by workers in Southeast Michigan. And we believe that by connecting with our customers on site, we are going to gain unique insight into the challenges they face and better be able to serve them. And that's our commitment. We want to gain insight into how we can serve better.
Everybody, that is Michigan's Unemployment Insurance Agency Director, Julia Dale. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to join us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you very much.
And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Also, I know we name dropped a lot of different bill packages today. So in case you want to look them up, the bills that are being spearheaded by Southfield Democratic State Senator Jeremy Moss and Upper Peninsula Republican State Senator Ed McBroom to extend the Freedom of Information Act, making legislators and the governor susceptible to Freedom of Information Act public records request. Those bills are Senate Bills 669 and 670. Additionally, as for the legislation we discussed in our second segment, authorizing the creation and recognition of surrogacy contracts, with a slate of guidelines for the contract framework and negotiation process, the bills consist of House Bills 5208 through 5215. Now it's time to thank today's guest. I am extremely grateful for the time of Executive Director Nick Pigeon of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network and Lisa McGraw, the Public Affairs Manager of the Michigan Press Association, who took time to participate in the Sunset on Sunshine roundtable discussion. Also, thank you to founder Stephanie Jones of the Michigan Fertility Alliance and Director Julia Dale of Michigan's Unemployment Insurance Agency. I would like to express my tremendous gratitude to MERS editor Kyle Malin for helping me plan today's episode and for MERS administrative reporter Andrew Miniker for joining us on the third segment with Director Dale. And last but not least, thank you so much to Mark Bayshore of Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos, which is responsible for putting this audio together. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Shriver.